Broadcasting from Lockport, New York, it's time for The Dads Must Be Crazy. Just three guys raising kids and currently hiding from them in an undisclosed tool shed to talk about parenting, pop culture, and penguins. Or something else that starts with a P. It's Craig, the stay-at-home dad historian and hockey enthusiast. Howie, the stay-at-home dad who used to be a reporter when journalism was a thing. And Bobby, the retired Army vet, Trekkie, and gamer, helping to raise three kids in beautiful Western New York. Now, here's the dads.
Welcome to The Dads Must Be Crazy. I am Craig, joined today by Howie.
Hello.
And Bobby.
Howdy.
And we have a special guest, Brandon Stickney.
Brandon Stickney. I like the sound of that.
Yes.
Oh, that's my name. Okay, good. Thank you.
It's going to fit right in.
We're going to talk today a little bit about a book that Brandon wrote, The Five People You'll Meet in Prison. And so tell us a little bit about the background of the book. I know a little bit. I can tell you, as we get started here, that the night of the accident, I was there.
Yeah.
And I definitely heard the car crash, and then you hit the ground. I was that close. I was right there at the corner. And that kind of starts off this whole narrative, doesn't it?
Yeah. Locust and Walnuts. There was I went to cross the street because I was going to go into the press area of the Friday night concert there. It was Kenny Wayne Shepherd Band, and they were pretty much on their last song, Blue on Black. And I went across the street, and at the same time, the light was changing, and the guy was from Niagara Falls, I believe. He gunned it through the yellow light and took me out, hit me in the knees, and I actually my arms and legs were kind of splayed, so it was kind of like pinwheel. I flipped through the air and landed on my head on the pavement. There was a Lockport police officer who got there first, and he said, then the others were gathering, and the ambulance was there, and he said, investigate this as a fatality.
Wow.
And so I was in.
And you heard him say that?
No.
No? Okay.
No, he told me later.
Okay.
I went down to, after I was in ECMC for a month in recovery and learning how to walk again, then I went to Gasport Absolute Care for 3 week rehab. When I got home, it was either a call or a letter. I'm not quite sure what it was, but they wanted me to come down to City Hall and give me a ticket for crossing the street in the wrong area. Which is,
they want to give you a jaywalking ticket after all that?
They gave me a jaywalking ticket.
Wow.
Yeah. And
it's our government at work.
Well, I think it was one way they could put some kind of even minor roadblock in my way for crossing in an area that the city had set up for a rock concert, which was very dangerous. It was the rock concert is right in the middle of traffic, if you remember,
right,
the way it used to be set up. And then after that incident, they moved it behind the
library.
By
the library, yep.
Yeah. So, and then it failed out for various reasons that people kind of already know about. But anyway, that was actually a suicide attempt. At least I believe it was. At the time, I was borderline homeless, and I had no money, and my life was going absolutely nowhere. I believe that's what it was. I'm not 100% sure. But I was, why was I in the road at that? I keep questioning it over and over again. And that kind of leads into this story, The Five People You'll Meet in Prison, because I wound up, it was actually about a year before that, I had a script of, it was an anti-opiate drug called Suboxone. And I was taking that to stay off of opiate pills. It was really, really at the height, I believe, of the opiate problem in America. There were so many pills going up and so many people dying, something like 77,000 that year or something. And these are deaths. And the year, 10 years before that, there was 17,000. So you see the difference in how quickly it went up. These drugs are really so much stronger than maybe things that were taken years ago for pain or that people use recreationally. Very, very powerful and very difficult to say no to. And I was living in on Washburn Street in an area that was at the time kind of loaded with problems. And I was trying to get off of it and change my life. And it just didn't go that way. I wound up selling a drug to, they call them confidential informants. Now, what a confidential informant is a drug addict who has gotten himself or herself in a lot of trouble for using drugs, for possessing drugs, for selling drugs. And the police say, you know, or the drug, the task force down at the sheriff's department says, well, why don't you work for us? And we'll try to knock some, you know, we'll try to work with the prosecutor, et cetera, et cetera, and knock off some time, or maybe they'll go a little bit easier on you if we do that, you know, if you can work with us. So the person becomes a narc or a narcotics tattletale. I've read a lot about this, especially after starting to write the book. I wanted to know what the, because it seems a little weird, doesn't it? You take a drug addict off the streets and he starts working with the police. No police training. You know, other than here to put this microphone, put this as a, see this lighter here? It's really a microphone. So when you go into the person's house and they're going to try to sell you the drug, you put this lighter down on the table and you're going to record the whole thing. And then you're going to give it to us. We're going to give it to the DA and we're going to arrest that person. We're going to arrest 10 people and then we're going to arrest 20 people. And it's going to be a whole drug sting, you know, and oh my God, wow, the area police and the sheriffs, they're just working so hard for us, aren't they? All these investigations and all this. No, what they're really doing is they're taking people who are addicted to drugs and letting them continue to be involved in the activity of drug dealing. So you've got drug dealers working for the police, chasing down people who are drug dealing, and just let, when you let it kind of sink in a little bit, you realize that it doesn't make any sense. Why are taxpayers in this area, or in any area, paying for drug dealers? Because they get paid like $150 a hit. Well, so if why are taxpayers paying drug addicts to hang out with other drug addicts on the street? And you don't know what's going on in the house. The police officer doesn't go into the house and accompany the confidential informant. They go in themselves. So who knows what's going, what else is going on? What doesn't get put on tape? What gets slipped into somebody's pocket? What's really going on?
And let's make clear here, too. You're saying that there's drug dealing going on. And you got busted for drug dealing, but it wasn't like you were trafficking pounds of anything.
No, I'm glad. Actually, I'm glad you bring that up. There was, let's see, there was two recorded deals. I think they were about $80 each for wafers, they call them, of Suboxone, which is a drug that can intoxicate someone. And if it's used the wrong way, there are addicts out there who purchase it from people who have scripts for it through North Point or any of the agencies, Horizon. You know, these agencies try to help people get off drugs. And
so there's a positive use for these.
Well, that depends on how much you want to think about, because the Suboxone is something that helps people get off of heroin. So these days when heroin is with fentanyl, it can just kill anybody at anything. You know, it's just much more dangerous. And Suboxone takes away the craving for heroin and other opiate intoxicants, pills, things like that. But if the narcotic that's being stopped is being held off by another narcotic that can also cause intoxication, then what is the point of that? Because you can also become addicted to Suboxone. So, and this is just one of those things. I mean, I can't solve this problem. You know, I'm not a doctor. I don't know where the logic is in all of this. I was just caught in a sting, and about 10 other people were busted on the street on Washburn by this one guy. He told the police about what he alleged happened in my apartment, and this, you know, and this was put on tape, and I never got to hear the tape. There was a number of things with the case that I'm not going to go into right now, but it felt like the whole thing was just a real setup and that it was wrong. But I had done something wrong, so I admit it. I did do something wrong and deserved to be punished for it, and I was. I was allowed to go to drug court first, Judge Watson's drug court, and I was not able to keep up with my responsibilities in drug court, so I was kicked out, and I was sent back to Judge Clock, who had managed my case, and he sent me to he sentenced me to 2 years in state prison, and for approximately $80 drug sale, and. Suboxone can't kill. The laws are pretty much the same about Suboxone dealing or illegal deals. Unlike heroin, which can kill you or will kill you, Suboxone is one of those things that if you take too much of it or whatever, it peaks out and it just doesn't work. It's just basically like drinking too much water. So anyway, I was sentenced to state prison. I spent a little time in the county jail waiting the prison bus to come get me and a number of other people. And I was really scared for my life. I still am, very much. I think my mental illness, which is one of the reasons that I began drinking when I was 16 years old, is I just couldn't handle the depression and the difficulties of life at that time. And I believe that I was suicidal at that. Alcohol took away the pain and took away that ugly monster that lives in the back of somebody's mind who has mental illness. And it says, you can't, won't happen, not to you, you're no good. And it keeps going on with, you know, it's just extremely negative and paralyzing. And that's when I began using copious amounts of alcohol. And shortly after that, by the time I was 20, I was using cocaine.
In the midst of all that, though, you were a successful writer, journalist here in Lockport. You wrote a book about Tim McVeigh. You were married with a family. Did you keep that hidden from them, from your parents and from your wife and stuff? Or was there a point where they knew, and were they trying to help you? Or
I think my family, I would just say we were kind of like good times, you know? It was in the 80s and the 90s. During that time, we had never been very religious. We certainly weren't conservatives. It was just kind of all about fun. And I know people live very differently than that. But I was working for the Union Sun-Journal, and I was there for 5 years. And a number of my stories were picked up by the Associated Press Wire. So I was really moving forward. Then I was hired by a publishing company, and then I was hired by Mercedes. And things just kept going up and up and up. And we bought a beautiful house on Morrow Avenue. And my daughter and my wife and I were there. We had two cars, made great money, excellent company in Amherst called RSA, which was owned by Mercedes. And we were doing really well. And all along that time, I was kind of a weekend, you know, partier, weekend, you know, heavy drinker. And things were much different then. It just seemed like there were bad things associated with drugs, but there was also, I think at that time, the movies I watched, the authors that I read, the people I wanted to be like, you know, Hunter Thompson and Charles Bukowski and others who were really my heroes, Ernest Hemingway.
Kind of like gonzo journalism.
Yeah. They were people who used, and they also worked in the media. They were alternative writers, and they were the ones who were my heroes. You know, people like James Patterson, or you would call them pure or clean writers or whatever. They weren't people who challenged the government. You know, they weren't people who challenged the things that I'm concerned with now. You know, I mean, being kind of a prison reform advocate, or being a law enforcement reform advocate, that's what I feel that I am, that I'm doing, that I'm writing about. I think that's really important right now, because we have, as I learned in my research when writing the book, we have 2.3 million people in state prisons in America, and in other prisons and in jails and things like that. And right now, what's, I think, politically and socially important about it is that these people, who I was one of them, they are basically in death camps, I believe, because they are very susceptible to COVID-19. It's killing people who are being put in jail, people who are being put in prison, and it's kind of like a new death penalty, really. And I see a kind of responsibility on the part of law enforcement that they're tossing these people into these prisons, which are poisoned. The prisons are poisoned. They can't get it out of there. Once you're in there, there's no escape. You know, they're not going to provide you in prison. There are people who are in prison who don't have soap. They don't have underwear. They don't have socks. They don't have a blanket or a pillow, because these prisons either won't provide them, or they're corrupt or what. And this is happening right in America. You know, we're not talking about the ICE detention centers with the Spanish people. This is happening all over the place in all 50 states. Just imagine you yourself get a DWI or something. Maybe you do something, you know, you do something bad and you wind up in a jail or you wind up in a prison. But now it's so different, because not only do you face death from the gangs, from the drugs that are in there, from the COs, who are extremely dangerous people, very easy to ignite, you also face it from this invisible virus, which is tearing, killing people every day. Now, we, on the other hand, who are not currently in prison or incarcerated, are not as endangered necessarily, because we can move around. We can make ourselves protected. We can stay away from areas, and they can't.
Aside from the Nyer County Jail, how many facilities were you in during your two-year sentence?
I was in four prisons. Three of them were in the Buffalo area, and one was in central New York in the Mohawk Valley.
Now, a lot of people, when they think of prison, they think of Orange is the New Black, which is the popular show that just went off the air, what, 2 years ago?
Don't know. Never watched it.
And they have the like a almost like a dormitory thing. Were any of your experiences like that, or they're darker, like Oz type of thing?
Both. My first experience with prison was to be taken out of the Niagara County Jail and put on the prison bus. You know, it's extremely uncomfortable. They put they don't only put handcuffs on your hands. They put a box around the handcuffs, so you have very, very minimal movement. And then they, you know, when lunchtime gets to you, they hand you a bag of food. Now, how are you supposed to eat it when you can't move your hands? You can't. You know, you have to basically lift it up if you can and try to eat out of the bottom of the bag. It's just ridiculous. And it's one of the many human rights abuses that are out there in our state prison and right here in the Buffalo area. The first ride, a couple of things were going on. We were going to Wendy Correctional, which when you go on Google and you call up a map, you see that Wendy Correctional is 35 minutes away from here. Why did the bus ride to get there that I was on take 3.5 hours? 3.5 hours for 35 minutes, you know, which I found out later was basically kind of a corrections officer overtime thing. So they get paid more money if they take longer to get to the prison, which is more, you know, corruption that's in there and built into the system. And went to Wendy, and that was kind of like Oz. That was, you know, they just toss you in a cell and just ignore you. You know, you don't know anything. You don't know, will there be dinner? Are we just supposed to sit here? And the cells are absolutely filthy. So I can just imagine the COVID thing going through these prisons. And the cell is so dirty that if you take your finger and rub it along the wall, it will come back black.
And that's a maximum security prison, correct?
Yeah, maximum. Yep. So I was there, and then they transferred me to something called the Elmira Correctional Facility Reception Center.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Sure.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And of course, Craig, I think of the people here as the only one who's actually read your book, which I apologize that I haven't yet. But
I haven't read it either.
Well, you lived it, so I'm yeah. My question is, what rationale were you given to be sent to a maximum security prison for a low level? Was it a low level, or was it a felony? Yeah. Drug?
It was considered a felony.
Okay.
Because the legislature looked at Suboxone as being as dangerous as heroin, which it's not.
Okay.
Something to help people. It's not something to kill people.
In the grand scheme of things, though, over $80, essentially, you were sent to a maximum security prison. Am I understanding that part of it right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And that was their rationale, was that because of what the $80 is for? That's what they said.
They didn't give me any rationale. Judge Clock, who I do admire and respect, hit the gavel on the table. He said 2 years, and the next thing I knew, I was on a prison bus, and it was taking 3 hours to go the trip of a half an hour.
The prison that you go to, is that determined by the county? How is that determined?
Wendy was actually kind of just a holding place.
Okay.
For me and a bunch of others, as the Department of Corrections in New York State figures out where they're going to put you, which doesn't make much sense either, be a low level, considered low level drug dealer, whatever. And yes, I did have a felony, and I was put in with people who were just as dangerous as, you know, someone who would be put into a Supermax.
So
they just toss you into a room and they just leave you there, and then they put you into a cell, get lucky. It's just chaos. The whole system is completely chaotic and makes no sense.
Is the option there they could have kept you at Niagara County Jail and then transferred you from there to your regular, to basically your new home?
I wish I could tell you. I don't know why I went from Wendy. Well, I do know part of it is that the government pays the individual jails money for even a one-night stay for a prisoner. New prisoner, old prisoner, wherever they move you around. These prisons are reimbursed by the federal government considerable amounts of money for my overnight stay. So it would be like, this is how much it costs to go to the Hilton, a beautiful room, you know, and everything else. And basically the treatment I was given was, you know, you're going into a prison, and my meals, everything, anything they gave me cost about 2 cents a day.
How long were you at Wendy for then?
Wendy was about a week and a half, approximately. It was kind of hard to tell how many days went by because there's no calendars. There's no clocks. You know, you're just like, is today Thursday or is it Tuesday? You just don't know.
Not to make light of the situation, that's what every casino in Vegas looks like. There's no calendars, there's no clocks, and everything. Every time you go in, the atmosphere doesn't change. And that feeds into, you know, the Gamblers Anonymous type thing there. But that was my lame attempt at humor given this story, so I apologize. But
yeah, no, it's all right. It's addiction. Our prisons are full of addicts, and there's nothing to deter addiction or curb it in any way in any of our prisons. Nothing, absolutely nothing. If you've been to drug court and you go through that, the whole process there, it's basically the simplest way to explain it is thou shalt not. Or we'll send you to prison. And then you go to prison and you're surrounded by drug dealers who are dealing drugs in prison everywhere you go. So how is that making anybody any better? How is that correctional? It's not.
So you go around to Wendy and then you went to Elmira. And the title of the book is The Five People You'll Meet in Prison. And you said you met five people in the course of your sentence who helped you through your life behind bars.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us anything about like the first person you met who helped you?
The first person I met was in Elmira, and they call it the reception center, which basically means they are indoctrinating you indirectly as to how your ass will be kicked for the rest of the time while you're in our prisons. There's no real reception. There's no welcome to prison. There might be
not a party.
Absolutely not. There might be it depends. You know, once the lights are out, you know, who knows what's going to happen. The reception center in Elmira, I found, was just that's where I really noticed kind of the most corruption of anything. And that's also a maximum. You know, I mean, a CO came right up to me and looked me dead in the eye and said, I'm going to kick your ass today. For no reason. I hadn't done anything wrong. I was just standing in line waiting for breakfast, you know, and he just like, and that's the, you know, this intimidation, this rule, this, you know, they treat you like complete animals, and that's supposed to be correctional. I don't know. I say it over and over again, but, and the first person I met, he was like kind of a guardian angel, came out of nowhere. His name is, in the book, Big Bear. His handle. Everybody has a handle. Nobody has a name like Bill or Joe. You know, everyone has a different kind of handle. Cougar, Fish, you know, whatever. There's just nutty. Many of them are hip-hopper names. They borrow the hip-hop name. Bear just came out of nowhere, and he noticed that something was wrong. And I was profiled, not only by the corrections officers who were on the bus, but also by other inmates. And I didn't know it, but I was being profiled as a sex offender because I'm overweight. I wear glasses sometimes. I have no tattoos. I speak in an intelligent manner. And that's basically the inmate code for you being a sex offender, you being a child molester or internet porn guy or something.
And that's
like that.
Not a good thing in prison.
No, absolutely not. They'll kill you. They'll cut your face. They'll kill you for being that. And I wasn't that. I sold the drug. But that's how God, they're like a bunch of little old ladies, just very gossipy and, oh, that guy over there, look at that, you know, and they go on and on. And what I found out was that the Wendy corrections officers were promoting that myth about me because they want to, they will, they want to, and they will provoke fights
Did the COs at Wendy actually know the reason you're there? It seems like
they
maybe
have, they have access. They can find out very easily. Yeah, it's not a secret.
Now in the book you say that you're supposed to have paperwork from your lawyer, and you didn't have it. If you had that paperwork, then this all would have been disregarded anyway.
Yeah, my first lawyer quit twice. Judge Clark said, you know, these guys aren't ping pong balls. You can't take their case and then quit and take their case and then quit. So I don't know what was going on in the public pretender's office, but I had a second one. She would come in and just stand and stare at the judge. She would kind of glance at me, and we never had a talk about what my defense was going to be or how she was defending me, what her role was, nothing. So I didn't know. I figured the judge and her talked behind the, you know, and there was never anything. It was just, you know, this is just a quick side. I had my grandmother was dying at the time that I was going to be sentenced. I went to ask my public defender, may I speak to the judge? Because, you know, this is happening and I'd like to at least go to her funeral while I'm being held as an Niagara County. Said, oh, no, absolutely not. You can't talk. And I said, well, you know, I'm a journalist and an American. Of course I can talk to the judge. You know, I can fire you in a second, which I should have done. But I didn't because I was young and stupid and it was my first real crime, real crime. I said, well, I'm going to talk to him. And I just started talking to him, Judge Clark, and he listened. He understood. He looked at the prosecutor and he said, what do you think here? This guy's asking to let out. The prosecutor looked at me and then he shook his head and he said, no, mental illness combined with drug addiction. We don't really want him back on the street before he's sentenced. The judge says, well, I think we're dealing with somebody different here. We don't normally have this kind of person in our courtroom. I go, oh boy, here we go. You know, he says, do you know this guy's written two very well-reviewed books? One about Timothy McVeigh and one about the Seven Sutherland Sisters. And I'm like, I believe he's saying all this stuff. And then he researched my case that much to know that. And he's a businessman as well. He worked successfully at Mercedes-Benz and just saying all this. And I'm like, oh, thank God. Thank God this guy read, you know, thank God somebody knows something, because obviously he knew more about me than my public defender. And he let me out. He let me out. I was out for 2 months. Went to my grandmother's funeral. I was going to North Point. I made some mistakes. I didn't take a urine test and I was sentenced then, you know. But I thought that was, see, that's why I like Judge Clark, because he's fair, he's honest, he looks into the case, he knows who the people are who he's sentencing. And I saw him sentence a number of people while I was waiting to be sentenced. I was really smart. But in Elmira was horrible. Elmira was some mice and rats and cockroaches, and I had my own cell, which I actually preferred to be in a cell. You know, you almost feel protected in your cell.
So what did Bear do?
What did Bear do? Yes. Bear intervened on my behalf with the people who were spreading these rumors, and you know, because they'll really get you in Elmira if you're a sex offender or you've done something to a child or whatever. He said, Brandon's, you know, he's not like that. You're wrong. You're getting, you know, they had no proof, of course. And so Bear did that, and he'd eat lunch with me because we were right in the same row of cells. He got books for me, and he really helped me through. He told me how I need to protect myself, even indirectly to protect myself from having something bad happen. So he was a real hero to me. And then when I was moved from Elmira to Collins, he was there. We had been separated, and then he was there, and he was writing a book, and he wanted me to help him edit the book. And I was helping him every day with this book he called Hustle. And he was a good writer. Bear was a really good writer. He's Native American and Italian, and he just became one of the five immediately. And he's the one who gave me the idea to say, you know, because then there were other people who came along the way who just kind of helped me. And they were just, you know, one was he wanted to be a pastor, and he had committed a crime, and he was working toward it, and everything was about the Lord. And each one represented something. Like Bear was literature, and Pastor Mark was spirituality and religion. And then Gummy was somebody I met at another prison, Marcy, that I was in. Gummy was kind of a hockey goon, you know? You know, the Hanson brothers, he was like one of them, you know? And he was just this big, huge guy, and I called him Gummy because he didn't have any teeth. And he would eat an apple with no teeth. I don't know how he did that. It was just amazing. It was really quite fascinating.
He's hard as woodpecker lips.
And then there was a CO who, he was kind of, I call him Vale 4. which is Friend of the Devil, you know, Garcia. So many of them, they were just so mean and threatening and dangerous. And I saw people getting whacked with these clubs and knocked down and kicked and all over these prisons just all the time. And it's like, what did they really do that was that wrong? You know, they just leave them laying there. They'd crush them up against the cement wall. And it was just sickening. It was so absolutely sickening.
This Balfour... What did
was
he do
the total
for you?
Opposite of that. He said he used to be that way when he was a young CO, and then he developed a conscience because he had a wife, family, and he realized that what he was doing when he was going to his job was wrong, the way he was treating people who didn't deserve to be treated that way. You know, people have done things wrong. I think it was Wayne Kramer from MC5, the 60s band, and he said, "We were sent to prison as punishment, not for punishment." Which is really profound, I think, because it's just the difference between, I just don't believe that the majority of 323 million people in America, Americans, really want nonviolent offenders in prison to be beaten to death with clubs. Because, and, you know, handcuffed and beaten to death. And it happens all the time in all the prisons. It's just covered up.
How long into your stay did you get the itch to start writing this book? I mean, it wasn't an instantaneous thing.
No, I knew that I was going to write something. I had written so much before, and I had seen other prison books, especially from the 60s, the 1960s, guys who were tossed in there, Eldridge Cleaver, others, Wayne Kramer, people who went against the grain of what the prevailing American thought was, the McCarthyism and all that. And I said, well, maybe this is going on now. And then when I saw the abuses happening and everything, I just started keeping notes. They give you notebooks, which I couldn't believe. They won't give you toilet paper, but they give you a notebook. I just started writing down everything that I saw and every conversation that I had. And it developed on its own. I mean, one thing, I kind of wanted to do an essay for Esquire called Life Among the Sex Offenders, because when I was in Collins Correctional, which is near ski country, it was 60% sex offenders there, and I just couldn't. How can there be 60% of what is it, 3,000 people, sex offenders, all of them, really? You know, wow. And so, you know, I interviewed some, and, you know, so that was like a little tiny essay that I had. And then I did an essay on smoking. Like, the prisons sell you cigarettes, right?
You don't smoke either.
I don't smoke. No, I hate the habit. Never even tried one. I just hate the smell. And they sell cigarettes to the inmates, and then they bust them for smoking in the bathroom. But they don't let the inmates outside to smoke. I don't understand any. And there's so much about it is contradictory, just backwards. So Balfour, he was somebody who was he was humorous. He was the good-hearted kind of guy. You know, he was on the side of the devil, which I viewed the law enforcement in the prisons to be the devil, because they were given.
He's got to walk a line.
Power.
He had to walk a line. Like, listen, I am still in charge, but we can still speak. That type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and he was very open about it, and he was liked by the other COs. And, I mean, when I'd be walking down the sidewalk, when another CO would come up to me and start harassing me, and Balfour would be there in the road nearby. He says, no, no, he's all right. He's an officer. Let him go. No big deal. And he just got to know us like that. And normally you don't talk to a CO when you're in prison as an inmate, because you'll be accused of being a narc. And then you're back into the hole. And then you're into that thing again, playing both ends against the middle, or people will say that you are. You know?
You don't touch upon this in the book, but I have to ask, were you allowed visitors during the time that you were in prison? And did you have any?
I was allowed visitors, but I didn't want them.
Okay.
My parents are, they're older now. You know, they used to be kind of 60s hippies, which is where I got a lot of my ideology from. They've grown older, and they're Trumpers. And we don't really agree on any of that at all, but I wouldn't have wanted them there. And my daughter is, she's gone off to, you know, work in professional life. She was in college at the time, and I wouldn't have either. I don't want anybody to see me like that. When you have a visitor, they come in, you meet them, whatever. They get harassed by the COs just as much as you do. They might get kicked out. They might drive 3 hours to come see you. And the CO says, I don't think I like your look. Get out of here. And then they drive 3 hours back home without having seen you. So it's really horrible and awful for the relatives of the you know, loved ones. You know, I wouldn't have wanted it, because they are freedom. When you see someone on that other side of that wall, the other side of those bars, or the other side of the window, they are freedom. And then they get up and leap, and you're still stuck back in that hell. No, I wouldn't have wanted to visit her.
So in one of the things here, it's a memoir of addiction, mania, and hope. You talked about mental illness. Are you comfortable talking with that about that a little bit?
Yeah, I'll talk about anything.
Bobby, you have a degree in psychology, so you probably know a little about what he's going to talk about.
He's making a face like this guy over here is nuts. What is he here for?
No, just listening to the story, kind of taking it all in. I do work in the mental health field, more on human services side, but it does help to have a degree in psychology. I did look you up before I came. There was an article with the Lockport Sun and Journal written in, I think, September of last year. Read that article, and it did mention about your mental illness in there, and it was specific, and it named it. And I was like, oh, okay, got it. I mean, I've had friends who've been diagnosed with that. I actually work with people who have that diagnosis. So I work
bipolar.
With
bipolar.
Yeah, absolutely.
Having bipolar now is, as I understand it, just through going through Facebook and the notices that I get, it's actually, women find it to be very sexy, you know, especially when you're down and depressed and then you're up and, oh, you know, you're all hanging. So it's nice.
Jeez.
Oh my God. As long as I take my medication, I'm fine.
I know you have to leave, Howie. You have anything you want to add?
I'm taking a full load of courses right now in college, but when the semester's done, this really looks like something that, on the inside, it called it a combination of Shawshank, Oz, and Orange is the New Black. So if that's the case, the pop culture guru in me, who missed a pop culture reference earlier today, but we won't talk about, I'm looking forward to reading this. So, yeah.
And the other thing is, and Brandon and I spoke about this on the phone a couple of weeks ago. I asked him if he was going to write any more books. He goes, no, but I'd like to help people who want to write a book, write a book. And I know you're writing a book.
I am.
So you may have
I got somebody to bounce ideas off of. I'm writing a book, and in the process of writing one, I came up with ideas for two more. But of course, originally the goal was, you know, 6 years ago, I'm going to be published by the time I'm 40. Well, 40 happened this summer. So now the goal is I'm going to be published one of these days.
It's good to have
yeah. So anyway, but like Craig said, I do got to go. You guys keep going, though. I wish I could stay longer, but I got to go make sure that everything's copacetic at home, and I got to run another errand before I get home. So,
all right. Thanks, Howie, for coming.
Yep.
And we'll try to start winding down here a little bit, too. We're coming up on our time, and I know you got to be home for other things. But I do want to touch upon mental illness, your bipolar, how that affected you before you went into prison and then during prison. How that affected you there also, and how you've been since you've been out of prison?
Well, a lot of people say who knew me in high school when it really hit. And the reason I think that, because it waits. It just waits. It's in there. It waits to pop out, and it waits for a moment that challenges you. My grandfather passing away, my family and I moved to Charlotte, North Carolina, then we moved right back because he died. And this was right around the time that I was 14, and I think it really hit when I was 16, and that's when I started self-medicating with alcohol. And a number of people who've read the book, I knew these people in high school and in college. Some said they didn't notice, some said they did. Bipolar is hard because you can't really put it into a box and say this is it, because it's different for different people. Mine would be I'd be just up, wide awake and working like I did when I was working on the McVeigh book, and then really down other times and unable to even go to work. I did not get actual medication. I didn't start my medication for it until 2015. And ever since then, it's been much better. I have to be careful what I do and careful what I put in my body and things like that. And I'll be even keeping doctor's appointments. You know, you just can't miss any of that, and you can't miss a dose of your medication, or it'll really affect you a lot, and it affects all the people around you, you know. And what I've found is that it's very isolating. It can be very isolating because, you know, friends and people like that, they don't want to deal with your ups and downs and all of that. You can't lean on them necessarily, and you shouldn't. You have to have a doctor to be able to talk to, and counselors and people like that. The worst part, I think, really is the loneliness of it. And when I'm working, it's kind of like Joyce Carol Oates, our other author from Lockport, another one from Lockport. She says when she writes, she is the invisible writer, because when I, you know, I feel it, I know what she's talking about, because you disappear. You disappear from the desk and the table and your computer and everything, and you're just gone, because the story is what is living and what is happening. And to be, to have that spell broken, it's there, you're back to this reality that people basically told me that's kind of the universal answer about what I'm affected by, is that it's a sadness that they find me to be sad.
And did you get help throughout your sentence for that? Did you obviously met with prison psychologists?
I did. Some were very, very good and some were awful. My affliction, disease, whatever you want to call it, all of them, I guess there's more than one, protected me in some ways. It kept me out of some situations, out of some cell blocks and things like that, and put me into places like in the Niagara County Jail. It put me in the SHU, S-H-U, Special Housing Unit, I think that's what it's called, where I was just away from the absolute chaos of what was going on outside of me. And it kind of protected me. But it's as bad as it is good toward creativity. It motivates me to work harder, to disappear into work. And that's very difficult. It's hard to keep a steady girlfriend. You know, it's hard to have people around you who love you, because they don't live like that. They don't live inside of a story. They don't live inside of a computer. They live in their life, and I don't want to.
Well,
because when I'm living life, it's difficult.
I've got several 3- and 4-letter diagnoses myself. You know, I know exactly what you're saying with trying to have people around you that love you and support you, because everybody needs that support system. So a combination of therapy through a counselor or a psychologist, and then med management with a psychiatrist or your general practitioner. And then, you know, having a good set of coping skills, like you like to write, you get lost in it. And, you know, that's a thing for you. For me, I like to cook, but I can't cook 24/7. Otherwise, I got no food left in the house, and it's gone bad in like 2 days, and now I got to go buy more groceries.
Yeah, right.
You know, so I've come up with a whole bunch of little things. And, you know, when I was a lot younger, I wasn't very empathetic at all. And I would say mostly when I was in my early 20s. Well, my 20s and my teens, I wasn't very empathetic. I was just like, whatever, just suck it up. But part of that, you know, comes from being in the military for 20 years, you know, and being a combat vet, you know, like, hey, just rub some dirt on it, you know, take some Motrin, drink water, take a knee for a second, get back at it, you know. But as I've gotten older, my children have gotten older, my wife and I, we've been together for over 20 years now, and you kind of can't help but become more empathetic. And so because of that, I got my degree in psychology, and now I'm getting my graduate in child, youth, and family services. And because I work in that environment, mental health is a key part of things. When you're talking about the lack of people around you, I think we have to look at society as a whole and look at the psychology behind that. Like, everything is such an instant gratification thing now. Everybody wants instant gratification, and I want it to be about me, 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 me. What are you doing for me? Hey, well, if you're around me, well, what does that do for me? And if people aren't getting what they feel they deserve, then they're out. And I'm not saying that you're not giving them what they deserve. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is they're probably like, well, this is not doing anything for me. Social status. Oh, I feel this is more trouble than it's worth. And to me, I think that's weakness on their part. I don't think that has anything to do with you. If I were you, I wouldn't even look at it that way. I would just look at it that, you know what, that individual's not strong enough to be around someone like you and, you know, have a friend like you or be invested in you, you know, for a period of time, however long that may be. So I think when we look at the way society is today, I mean, there are some people who are very, very weak-minded, and they're just like, I just can't do this. I can't. It drives me insane. I've got a buddy I love to death, raging alcoholic. Love him to death. I take a bullet for him, trying to get him to lay off, you know, the devil's nectar. He won't do it. I'm like, dude, you're going to catch like a D-dub, or, you know, you're going to get stupid one night and you're going to decide to hop behind the wheel and you're going to run somebody over, and then shit is really going to hit the fan, bro. I'm not going to give up on him. Like, we've been friends for a long time. I love him to death, and I'm not going to give up on him. So But that's part of me, again, is I'm a very loyal person. Like, if I say I'm your friend and I'm going to be there for you, well, damn it, I'm going to be there for you, because my word still actually means something in this day and age. And I think that's...
And I've put you to the test on that a couple times.
And have I not been there for you?
You have.
You pulled me out of a doggone barbecue. I'm fixing to eat a smoked pork shoulder, and this man pulls me out of a barbecue. And what did I do? I showed up and had his back. My word is my bond, and I always try to live by that. Something my dad taught me when I was young. And even though I may have been a little crazy in my younger years, I mean, I'm instilling that in my kids. And I think society has gotten away from that. And that's part of the issue. There's a lack of loyalty. It's all about me. What can you do for me? How do you make me look when we're together? I don't think it has anything to do with you. I think it just has to be, I think it's the fact that the people that seem to be drawn to you right now are weak. And I just don't think they're strong enough to handle an individual as robust as you are. I wouldn't take that as a negative towards you. I would just say, you know what? They're weak. Eventually, you're going to have strong people gravitate towards you, and they're going to stick. And you just go on from there. You just got to bide your time until then. That's kind of my two cents anyway.
And that's a good point that you make, because the book is, these five people came to me. I didn't seek them. They were, you know, carried me through in various ways, spiritual, through what I love the most, literature, just through all these different ways, humor. And in the end, there was, I call him Gandhi in the book. He had a different nickname in prison, but he was like the philosopher. You know? He was a highway person. He just wanders the road. He wanders around. That's what he does.
So he had wanderlust.
Yeah. He was somebody incredibly smart. Somebody I wound up worrying about, you know. I mean, I kind of worry about the whole group of people who were close to me during that time, because I didn't want them to wind up back in prison for whatever reason. He wound up back in there and then got out. Drinks a lot of cough medicine. DMX junkie.
I was going to say, like Robitussin, yeah. DM. Yeah, he's doing that whole robo-tripping thing.
And that's what he does. So whenever he calls me, I just say, okay, well, you sound like you're having a pretty good time. I'll call you back later.
That's like a 5 to 6 hour trip, if you've ever seen somebody do that, because they'll slam half a bottle of Robitussin and wait about 10 minutes and make sure their stomach isn't upset, and then they'll slam the other half of the bottle, and then you just trip balls for like 6 hours.
I can't even imagine. I had Vicodin for a prescription one time when I got a concussion, and I took it once and I could not stand it. I don't like being not in control, and I felt like I was not in control, so that was it. I just lived with the pain from it, because I'm just not that person who can to keep taking it and not be in control. I don't like that.
I tell you what, I wound up drinking whiskey one night that had wormwood in it, and obviously I was over in Europe because it's illegal in the States, but I did have some alcohol that had wormwood in it, and I was tripping so hard. I swear I was crushing cars in the parking lot as I was walking. There was like tiny cities on the ground. I mean, it was
Godzilla.
It was insane. And as I've gotten older, like I haven't drank alcohol in 6 months because I just gave it up. And I look back on the past and I look at my consumption in the past and I'm like, I'm so much better without it. Now, other people can handle it just fine. Like, I don't even want to drink it. Like, don't get me wrong, I miss the taste. And when I do go on vacation to Scotland, I am going to have some scotch, because I'm not going to Scotland and not having a glass of scotch. That just sounds wrong to me, and I'm not going to do that. Right now, you know, I'm like super in control of my faculties. You know, obviously, I'm working towards my black belt. Alcohol is going to take away from that. I quit smoking over a year ago. I'm super healthy. I'm in great shape now. And I'm just like, yeah.
Round is a shape, right?
Round is a shape, sir.
Well, I'm perfect. Okay, so ultimately, this podcast is about parenting. And you are a parent.
Yeah.
Throughout your prison sentence, did you communicate with your daughter?
A little. We exchanged a couple letters, and she's an incredible photographer. She sent her photographs to me, and she works in marketing now. She's doing really well. I kind of employ her now. I have a job promoting other books for a publishing company, not my book. Well, mine a little bit, but of course I have to promote my own. But this is putting other books for a publishing company. And now listen up, ladies. I'm below poverty level, but I still make a little bit of money on it. It's good to work with her because I say, hey, you know, I'm doing this. Why don't you work on it with me? You know, create email blasts and just different design. She's very good with design. So that's been nice, is that we've kind of moved from, I mean, we'll always be father-daughter, but we've moved from that in, like, we work together in Martin. That kind of excited about that. During prison, I didn't see her. I didn't really want to write to her necessarily because it was so embarrassing to be there. Then once I started writing the book, I think I turned it around. I consider myself to be incredibly lucky. No one, I don't think, in very recent history has been able to go to prison for prison in New York and come out and be an author again. There were people all around me who thought those days were over. They weren't. They weren't. It actually was a kickstart to start my career all over again. I think that in involving my family, my father did some artistic renderings and photography for the book. And so it brought us all a little bit closer together. But to get out and have the book accepted, but also to get it's a small job, it's a part-time job, but to get started in something, it feels really good that it happened.
So the book is The Five People You'll Meet in Prison, a memoir of addiction, mania, and hope. Brandon Stickney is the author. You can pick that up locally, you said, at the Historical Society?
It's at the Historical Society. If anybody wants to write to me, I'm on Facebook. Amazon has it. Barnes & Noble, Walmart, anywhere. It's everywhere.
And I've seen a lot of people on Facebook talk about it, so it's definitely a popular book. I've read it several times. I wrote a review of it, so I had to read it a couple times just to get the message that was there, what I felt was there. I don't know.
Kirkus did a review. They're actually kind of the premier American book reviewer. A number of other publications did. I was on a few television shows.
I saw you in Chicago.
Twice there, two different networks. A couple of other things coming up. There'll be some local press that is being planned right now. A photo session coming on Election Day. So I think it's been going pretty well. I think when I have to look at sections of it to excerpt or whatever for a book review, or someone who wants, you know, a PR, a press kit. Whoever wrote this book is an extremely disturbed individual. It felt good to start over again, and it's kind of like step number one. You know, I still want to write to Judge Clock and send him a copy of the book and say, look, here's what I did, you know, here's what I did with my spare time when I went to summer camp.
Yeah. All right, so if you get a chance, read The Five People You Meet in Prison. Brandon, thank you for coming in and sitting in with us and discussing a little bit about your book.
Thank you.
And for Bobby and Howie, I'm Craig. Thank you for listening to The Dads Must Be Crazy. The Dads Must Be Crazy would like to thank Scott Leffler for putting together our awesome intro to the show. And thank you to Amanda Hodge, who helps us with our designs and logos. Intro and outro music provided by Incomptech.com. Our theme music is Retro Future Clean by Kevin McLeod, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0 license.